Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly.
Sex,
nationals. Mike and Rick tell you.
Early college, high school. Pain and suffering.
Learning and teaching.
In your face. In your face.
Your
face.
That they be preaching. Cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who is not nearly as dangerous as people used to think, according to the National Intelligence Estimate, Rick Hess!
You doing, Mike?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's an honor to be here with you. I hear you lit up the candle with this recent op-ed in the Washington Times.
Oh, well, that's kind of you. We're going to talk about that topic in a little bit.
Fabulous.
Catholic charter schools. That's...
Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Rick. And I, you know, you came in today all fired up about a George Will piece. What was wrong with that? It was a piece about charter schools. It quoted Education Next, where we both serve as editors. What was wrong with it?
It was, he had this assertion that we now know that when you get to 15% charter and choice schools in a district, that districts respond in important ways. Hmm. And, you know, we don't know any such thing. And people, you know, that number's up a fair bit from where people used to say we knew it was in 1997. I wish people would stop saying we knew things that we actually don't know anything about.
Is there anything that we know? I mean, we thought that Iran was dangerous. Turned out we didn't know that after all.
I know that you are a good-looking man.
Thank you, Rick. That's nice.
I like your shirt.
Yeah, yeah. Likewise, you're wearing a blazer. Rick is looking sharp, everybody, which those of you know who Rick among our listeners know that when he's wearing something nicer than jeans, it's an important day.
Digging it. We got the chairman's dinner, baby.
Good, good. Well, but seriously, though, you've been spending time, as we've been talking about, up in Harvard Ed School, and now you're all into talking about what we don't know. It sounds like you're questioning the very nature of knowledge itself.
Ooh,
kind of like a good constructivist.
I like that. Much like we tackle in my forthcoming book, When Research Matters, trying to understand what we do and don't know and how it affects policymaking.
Nice plug. Like it. Okay. Well, busy day today. We're going to, of course, play Part in the Gadfly. Then we've got an interview with Josh Dunn, who is going to talk to us about the Wisconsin virtual charter school decision, a court case that's really going to, I think, have a big impact in the online world.
I like Josh Dunn. He is a bright guy.
He is a bright guy. He's a professor, assistant professor.
A UVA alum.
UVA alum. And he's now at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs.
Good place to be.
I was going to say a beautiful place to get to study education.
But now it's important to be clear that Wisconsin decision is a state level decision.
It is. We'll get back to that later. But yeah, there was a big decision in Wisconsin, basically saying that virtual charter schools are not legal under the state law, in part because parents are not certified teachers.
Well, it's right. I mean, there's a lot of pieces there. But also, it's important to keep in mind that the Wisconsin court decision only applies in Wisconsin.
Well, that's right. But it could be a harbinger of things. I mean, because, you know,
indeed,
under the reasoning used in Wisconsin could probably be used in any other state.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And finally, Liam will impart some education news of the weird.
I like it.
All right, Christina, get us started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Topic one, Catholic charter schools. A good idea?
Could we be a little more precise here, Christina?
We're trying to whittle down our questions to the bare minimum.
Stay within the time limit.
We could have just gone with good.
So, Rick, what do you think? Charter schools.
Give me a little context. Give the listeners a little context.
All right, maybe. Fine. So in Washington, D.C., there are 7 inner-city Catholic schools that are facing a financial crisis. We've seen this all over the country, of course. Basically, they're serving poor kids who can't pay tuition, and the archdiocese is strapped for cash and can't afford to subsidize them any longer. So the plan is to turn them over to a nonprofit organization to run them as non-religious charter schools, values-based schools, but not Catholic schools. And I wrote a piece in the Washington Times saying, hey, why do we have to make this choice? Why not keep them as Catholic schools and allow them to be charter schools too?
Right. The listener's first question, Mike, of course, is what about the First Amendment?
What about that First Amendment? Well, in the Zelman decision that upheld the Cleveland voucher program, the court clearly said that that program was constitutional, even though most of the kids in the program were going to religious schools, because the parents had a wide range of choices, including secular public schools, charter schools, magnet schools. And so I'm saying, look, if there are 7 Catholic charter schools in Washington, D.C., but 100 secular charter schools, which there are, and 200 secular non-charter schools, regular schools, then there's plenty of choices that parents have. They certainly aren't being forced to go to a religious school.
I mean, I agree with the reasoning there. I mean, part of what we get confused here is we talk about a wall of separation between church and state. Of course, there is no wall of separation in the Constitution. This was a figure of speech that Jefferson used, an image. In the Constitution, we provide both that there shall not be establishment of religion by the U.S. government and also for the free exercise of religion. And, you know, clearly, if families want to send their kid to parochial schools and can't afford it or can't access those schools, one could make a reasonable case that free exercise is being inhibited. So there's a balancing act here. But, I think what this points to is that some of the ways in which charter schools have been advocated and defended, this big emphasis on making sure people know that they're, quote, public schools, unquote, has actually gotten in the way of us talking creatively about how the heck are we going to teach and help kids learn in the 21st century. And so, Mike, I made this argument, I think it was 02. I'm glad to have you on board, baby.
All right.
Knuckled up.
Loving it.
Next.
Shake and bake.
Boom. Okay. I feel it.
Speaking of which, we saw yet another Will Ferrell movie this week. I mean, we're trying to catch up on our Will Ferrell movies, Talladega Nights. I have to admit, we didn't make it through that movie because it was so bad.
I know. We never saw Talladega.
Yeah.
I feel kind of bad.
Liam disagrees. Oh, okay.
Next.
I'm looking forward to Walk Hard. Okay, Billy Cox story. That's his Christmas movie. You can see it in the theaters for change.
And at the rate you guys are going, we'll talk about it in 2010.
Oh! So ouch.
Keep going.
Okay, Christina.
Topic two. A new study finds that four out of five Texas fifth graders who fail the state test are promoted anyway, even though the state outlawed social promotion. Is this a sign of lax standards at the local level or local wisdom?
I think it's a problem. You know, in the article about this, it stated clearly that third graders are being held back at higher rates. More like half of the third graders that fail the test are being held back. By the time they get to fifth grade, I guess educators and parents and are worried that, well, the kids are going to really feel bad about themselves if their peers go on to middle school and they don't go with them, and it's going to harm them socially. But I don't see how it's going to help them to get to middle school, new school, you know, much more difficult environment if they don't have these basic skills. The tax is a very easy test. If they can't pass this test, they are not going to do well in middle school.
I mean, what's a little disconcerting here is it reminds me of those old bubblegum commercials, the 4 out of 5 dentists.
Mm-hmm.
Who was it?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Trident. Thank you, Liam. It was Trident commercials. 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Trident for those patients who chew gum, which is really kind of irrelevant here. Yeah, and no, I think, I mean.
Yeah, does it remind you of that?
Because it's 4 out of 5. I don't know. It got embedded in my head back when I was younger. Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, if, you know, on the other hand, if one is in these schools and trying to make decisions about what's actually going to serve these kids' interests, if you don't have a lot of confidence in the utility of the tax, either as a diagnostic tool or in terms of measuring, you know, useful metrics, then you can make the argument that they're, you know, trying to make decisions about what's in the kids' best interest and not simply comply with, you know, a potentially insensitive test. It's insensitive, technically speaking, not like emotionally insensitive. That said, I mean, I think the fact that 4 out of 5 kids are failing this test and getting pushed forward either suggests they need to take another look at the test, or that somebody needs to take a look at how these folks are making student assignment decisions.
You know, one last thing. What I love is that the teachers who are making these decisions to send the kids to the next grade are, of course, their current teachers.
Right.
I think if you had the teachers who are going to have them come into their classrooms get to make that decision, it might be a very different decision.
That's right. Or if you did looping strategies, so teachers were going to have to keep these kids, you can imagine that they'd suddenly look at this all differently.
Oh, especially if a fifth grade teacher had to go to middle school with the kid.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Christina?
D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty and Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee are making enemies on the city council for their brash style. Is this an inevitable consequence of trying to push change or a sign that the dynamic duo is politically tone deaf?
You know, Michelle's always struck me as somebody who is actually very politically attuned. And Fenty is actually, I don't know him, but he's always struck me as that way, although some of the recent coverage seems to suggest that maybe he's getting a little fed up with some of the city council and hasn't been quite as nimble as he might be. But the reality is, when you're talking about shutting down a dozen or two dozen schools, people are going to be up in arms and they're going to scream at you. And they're all, no matter how much time you spend hand-holding and trying to play the political currents, you're going to wind up with people screaming that you didn't do a good enough job.
Sure, but I, you know, just from the outside, just reading the articles in the newspaper, it seems like Fenty has shot himself in the foot a couple times now. For example, when Michelle Rhee was picked as chancellor, you know, he let the city council know about it, you know, something like 18 hours in advance. And actually, there was a law in the books that they were supposed to have more advance notice than that. When they come out with the school closings, again, they gave them last minute notice about the decisions that were being made. obviously people are going to be angry when change is coming down, but I don't see why you hurt yourself by giving that little, you know, that little notice. I mean, I remember when, you know, when I worked at the U.S. Department of Education as a Bush administration official, look, there were some things that I look back on and say, you know, we were doing things, we thought we were doing the right things and we were going to, you know, take charge. But, you know, an extra call here, a visit up to Capitol Hill there, you know, probably would have gone a long way on some of the decisions we made. It's just something that you do when you're working politically to try to form a consensus.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I wouldn't argue that at all. On the other hand, I think when we look at leaders who are making a difference, you look at the Vallises and the Kleins and the Bersons, you're always going to get these stories about them. And, you know, it's hard to gauge how much hand-holding and how many extra calls they're actually taking. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, when you're pushing for change, you can always count on people are going to be able to tell stories about how you were insufficiently sensitive. So it's hard. It's hard to know, you know, when those charges actually have merit.
Okay, Rick Hess still in love with Michelle Green, then.
Doing what I can, baby.
All right. Well, we now have a special interview with our Education Next colleague Josh Dunn about Wisconsin virtual schools. Let's take a listen. Joining us today on the Education Gadfly Show is Josh Dunn, assistant professor at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, and co-author of Education Next's Legal Beat column. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk today about a big decision that came out this week in Wisconsin regarding virtual schools. Basically, a appeals court at the state level struck down some of the schools that were operating there, saying that they were operating illegally under state law. Say some more, Josh. What was behind the court's decision?
Well, these virtual schools had been challenged by teachers' unions, and three claims that the teachers unions made. One was that because parents were so involved in teaching the kids in these virtual charter schools at home, that violated the state licensing requirement for teachers, that essentially the parents were teachers and therefore they needed to be licensed if they're going to occupy such a large role teaching their kids. The other was involved an open enrollment policy, and which required that students, if they're going to enroll in an open school, they actually have to live within the district where the school is located. And students were enrolling from across the state in these virtual schools. And then also there was some controversy over the physical location of the schools, where they were and what counted as the actual location of the schools. And so those were all the legal issues, and the appellate court evidently ruled that they violated the state legal requirements on those issues.
Okay. Now give us some national context, Josh. There's been some litigation around virtual schools in other states. Is this unusual?
No. There's been litigation, and I believe in Pennsylvania, Michigan. I think even out here in Colorado, there's been some hints of litigation. So there have been a few lawsuits. I believe this is the first instance where the virtual schools have lost. I believe most of the time that they've won these legal challenges.
Okay. So, and certainly, I can understand this requirement around open enrollment. That basically the way that Wisconsin law is written, it doesn't think about kids being able to enroll in a virtual school, you know, statewide. And so you could see the argument that
right.
The legislature's got to get around to changing the law. But this point about teachers or parents acting as teachers, it seems like that same rationale could be used in virtually any state to try to shut down these virtual schools. Isn't that right?
Oh, certainly. Yes. Essentially, the real problem with it is that how much time do parents have to be involved with their child's education before they become a teacher? And if you claim that anyone that occupies a significant amount of time with their child's education has to be certified, then that could easily shut down virtual schools across the country.
Right.
If states have those requirements.
Right. So what, and now, you know, now the judge in this case, you know, in his decision, he tried to make it clear that, look, you know, all I'm saying here is that if the legislature agrees with these virtual schools, they have to pass some laws that explicitly allow it. Is that line of reasoning, is that pretty typical? I mean, not to, you know, kind of allow where there's some gray area, allow some flexibility?
Yes, it does seem to be a reasonable interpretation of the statute. But I think the problem is that this statute was written, as you mentioned before virtual schools were even envisioned or thought of. And then, of course, they've made allowance for these virtual schools. So then the question is, how do you construe these competing laws? And so I think the judge probably, or the appellate court, could have arrived at a different conclusion, given that you have these contradictions or apparent contradictions, and so sometimes it's considered appropriate for judges to reconcile those types of statutory contradictions. So yes, I think it was reasonable, but they easily could have arrived at the opposite conclusion.
Okay, so what do you think, Josh? Do you think we're going to see more of these kinds of lawsuits around the country?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The teachers' unions certainly don't. They don't like school choice. They don't like charter schools. And so virtual charter schools are a substantial threat to them as well. And so you're going to continue to see litigation over them.
Okay. All right, Josh. Well, Josh Dunn from the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
So what do you think, Rick? Does this make you nervous about the future of virtual schools around the country?
I mean, I think it suggests that policymakers, you know, legislators want to have virtual schools. They actually have to enact laws which make it possible to do virtual schools, and that we shouldn't count on judges to turn a blind eye and opposed interest groups to quietly sit back. So much of the push for reform has been about pushing for easy, little, popular, digestible steps. Mm-hmm. And what this suggests is folks who actually want to open the door to meaningful reform have got to go ahead and rewrite these laws more broadly.
I think you sound like you're actually on the side of the unions in this one, Rick.
No, I just think that those of us who are for these changes haven't, you know, really made the energy to go back and rewrite the basic laws governing finance and regulation and everything else.
Yeah.
Instead, we keep wanting to just pass, you know, little patches, voucher programs, charter programs.
Yeah. But licensure. I mean, in this case, the question of, you know, if you have a program where the parents are playing a substantive role, but they're still not the teacher, there is a teacher of record someplace else. You know, that seems like a judgment call about whether that parent is a teacher or not and therefore needs to be certified. And I just don't feel like you need to go out and pass a new law in order to clarify that.
Although, there
should be some flexibility in the system to push the envelope. Parents are happy.
Yes, because this is what statutes are good at.
Well,
I mean, there's also, in fact, I think there's laws in the book, right, about districts can't operate schools outside their boundaries.
That's fine.
And
I agree.
Decisions.
Right. So that those points fairly set. Right. But the finding that the parents were acting as teachers and therefore need to be certified, I thought was ludicrous.
Actually, I don't know. I mean, I think
you're
wrong. Make a reasonable argument. It's like Checker just walked in. You can make a reasonable argument either way. But, I think, frankly, if for those of us who believe things like virtual schooling are important and useful, frankly, I'd much rather have us go out and convince legislators and convince voters that we ought to rewrite the rules rather than trying to do this stuff through, you know, trying to stretch, you know, to the breaking point, existing statutory language.
All right. I'll let you have the last word on that because it is now everyone's favorite time of the week, the time we wait for all week long, education news of the weird time. With our education news of the weird correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what is weird this week?
A Montessori education expert, Abraham Ogunkanbi, has decried the poor state and indiscriminate establishment of Montessori schools in Nigeria. Quote, "It is disheartening to observe the dominance of affluent Nigerians with no education background in the business of school ownership," unquote, Ogunkanbi said. He also warned parents not to enroll their children into schools bearing the Montessori name without first properly scrutinizing the school's staff. Ogunkanbi said to parents, quote, "You may end up paying highly for your ignorance," unquote. He also lambasted the government's overall support for elementary schools. Quote, "It is high time the Nigeria government, through the Ministry of Education, gave due regard to nursery primary education," unquote, Rick. Which is Nigeria's biggest problem? A, paramilitaries who operate in river deltas and kidnap foreign oil workers. B, overwhelming population growth. C, Sharia law in the north. Or D, ineffective Montessori schools.
I'm going to go with A for 200, Liam.
And that's education news of the weird. I'd say B, long term.
Well, I got to say, the kicker there was well constructed and humorous, but it wasn't all that weird.
I think Liam just liked the guy's name.
Mm.
How do you say that again?
I think it's Ogunkanbi. Mm-hmm.
Did they have a phonetic on the web, or are you just kind of taking a guess at that?
I mean, it was a Nigerian paper, so I don't think they would put the phonetic. I'm sure people in Nigeria know right away.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's disheartening that there is this, you know, anti-privatization movement going on in Nigeria. You know, I mean, I don't see why you have to be an educator to own a Montessori school in Nigeria. I mean, you could hire educators. This is like the same debate we always have about principals, you know?
Yeah, it's exactly the same.
I think we might
want to. I was trying to make this related to, you know, education.
We might want to take a vague look at this before we start piling in on one side or the other.
You know, Liam and Kobe once did this cartoon where they said Nigeria was a nation at risk.
Mm.
And it was this cartoon with Checker. Checker goes to a Halloween party and he's dressed up like Nigeria. And people look at him strange and he says, Liam?
I'm a nation at risk, damn it. Like the study.
It's not.
Yeah, but he's really a nation at risk.
It really works better visually.
I would imagine. I think where is this cartoon accessible?
Well, we should
to
put the
listeners.
Cartoon back up on the podcast homepage so people can see it.
Okay.
All right, we'll do that. All right, good. That's it, Rick. That's all the time we got for this week.
Wow, we enlightened our listeners once again.
We did indeed. Well, thank you for wasting your time, listeners, with us. But we had fun. Until next week, Rick.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.